Welcome to the HC Insider Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the commodities sector and the people within it. I'm your host, Paul Chapman.
Today we're talking with Ilya Bushuev about his new book, Virtual Barrels, Quantitative Trading in the Oil Markets. How oil trading has been changed by the entrance of huge amounts of virtual barrels. What are the most important virtual barrels? Who are the participants and what's driving them? And how has it changed the nature of trading? Ilya's book is a comprehensive exploration that details the evolution of quantitative trading in the oil markets and elucidates the trading models employed by hedge funds and professional commodity traders and introduces innovative approaches to pricing oil options and advancing the theory of storage. What follows is a discussion about how that theory is impacting the markets today and where it's headed. Dr. Bushuev is managing partner at Pentathlon Investments, an adjunct professor at NYU, and a senior research fellow at the Oxford Institute of Energy Studies. I'll put links to his book in the show notes. As always, you can really support the show by leaving a positive review on the platform you're listening on, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Ilya, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Paul. It's my pleasure to be here.
So we were just discussing, right? So the last time we had you on was episode 7, in the wake of COVID in July 2020, and we were talking about how negative oil prices came about, and still a very much relevant discussion today. So I would encourage listeners to go back and check that out. But today we are talking about your new book, Virtual Barrels, Quantitative Trading in Oil, which I assume is going to be a must-have on the shelves and desks of junior trading programs around the world in the commodities sector. But let's, just for a refresher, can you just remind us of your background and what you're currently doing?
Sure. A lot of things obviously have changed since our last conversation. Prices are no longer negative, so that's quite a change. But I do talk quite a bit what caused negative oil prices in my book. But going back to your question, so my background is I'm a mathematician by training. I joined the oil industry in 1997. As a quant, I worked for Koch Industries. My initial mandate was to build the pricing models, which took me about 3 months to do. After that, the management kind of looked at my models and said, Ilya, we don't know what to do with them. If you think your models make money, here is the phone, here is the risk allocation. Good luck to you. So I basically became probably one of the first geeks or quants or nerds in the oil industry back in mid-90s. And fast forward, I've been fortunate to be given an opportunity to build a derivatives trading business at Koch. And I basically ran it for 25 years, and after which I retired and became an educator. So I'm teaching at NYU and doing a lot of writing, including my recent book.
Am I right in thinking you are also a rocket scientist?
I would say you can call me that. I think sometimes I don't mind because it's good for marketing. And as you know, like in the oil industry, you have to be a good marketer. But yes, I did do some sophisticated mathematics before I get into the oil space.
Right, great. So it does indeed take a rocket scientist to understand some of this stuff. But okay, so your book has just been published. Can you, Virtual Barrels? Can we spend a bit of time understanding what's in it and why you wrote it?
Yeah, I mean, it really summarizes my experiences over 25 years. Pretty much, it tracks the entire evolution of quantitative trading in the oil space. As I said, I mean, back in early 90s, I was probably, at least people thought, okay, well, Ilya is a nerd. He must be the smartest guy in the room. When I was leaving the industry a few years ago, I probably was the dumbest guy in the room because everybody around me was so much more educated and so much faster. And I was surrounded by a lot of computers. And then I realized, well, someone has to document that whole history, how it evolved basically over 25 years. The actual name, Virtual Barrels, I assume everybody by now knows the term paper barrels. I think less people are probably aware that paper barrels existed for a long, long time In fact, some people could argue that the term paper barrels, basically financial trading, originated back in Western Pennsylvania sometime in the end of 19th century, because even back then, there were certificates, paper certificates, that were basically trading many more times than physical barrels. They effectively were trading as contracts for differences, which eventually became evolved effectively into futures prices. So everybody by now know paper barrels, but what changed recently, we no longer even write deals on paper. So everything is sort of virtual. It resides somewhere in the cloud. The deals are now driven by computers. And that's really what I thought about describing. And the sheer size of these financial virtual barrel markets is kind of mind-blowing. So if you think that we consume roughly, give or take, 100 million barrels per day of physical oil, but I think people don't understand that we trade 5 to 6 billion barrels per day of virtual barrels. Basically, by that, I mean all the futures and options and over-the-counter market. So that's like 50 to 60 times more. I know that some people can challenge me on that metric, but nevertheless, it's a fact. So we trade about, we consume 100 million, but we trade 5 or 6 billion. And basically, that's what the book is about. Like, who are they? And like, why they do what they do, how they have evolved over time. But the big focus on the book on specific trading strategies. Pretty much I describe what worked and what didn't for my business. And that's really what the book is about.
Yeah, because it's an academic book. It very much is about those trading strategies, how to calculate them, how to go about thinking about them as well, right? I mean, it's very much targeted, at least, as you know, for the professional trader out there or the aspiring trader.
Yeah, it is kind of academic, but I wouldn't want to scare people away. I think it's progressively getting more technical as you move on. So, I mean, I don't honestly expect many readers to go through the entire thing. But first part of the book, when we talk about futures trading, is pretty much for general audience, even though it does have a couple of basic economic theories, like the storage and hedging pressure. But I provide my own twist on this series, much more from a practical perspective. And that's where I talk, explain the nature of negative oil prices. And then the second part of the book is more for professional option volatility dealers. Yeah, that one is a bit more technical and academic. So I'm kind of trying, honestly, to cater both audiences. But I can see the first part is really for everybody.
Yeah. Okay, so, and you spent, as you said, you spent a lot of time on this, the scale of virtual barrels compared to the physical piece, and trying to understand the motive, who are those, unpick who those participants are and their motives. Can you give us some sense of sort of what are the most important virtual barrels when we think about this, and who they are and kind of what their drivers might be? I know that's a big question.
Yeah, I think that's a good question, because sometimes when people don't understand certain things, they come up with a generic term and they then blame everything that they can't explain on this type of participant. In today's market, people tend to blame like a CTAs for all the speculative market swings, pushing the market up and down. I think it's a little bit, it's not quite correct. First of all, not every CTA, which is a commodity trading advisor, trades algorithmically, but perhaps more importantly, there are many other trading companies, including physical trading companies, are now using algorithms to trade, even though they're not CTAs. So it's important sort of to differentiate between the two. But now I think a proper way would be to call virtual barrels algorithmic trading, regardless of how is it being executed. Not all of them, of course, are kind of created equal. They trade for multiple different reasons. And I would probably highlight a couple. So one, like more traditional, again, algorithmic trader tends to look at historical patterns and basically using sophisticated statistical analysis, including machine learning, trade based on a repetition of these patterns. Again, historically, those patterns were as simple as trend following or momentum. Now everything became incredibly more sophisticated. It's no longer just that. And those patterns straddle multiple asset classes, including general economic trends like inflation and stuff like that. But ultimately, they still trade based on historical patterns. I would say the other big group of virtual barrels, I call them like risk parity funds, which essentially allocate to oil as a hedge against the portfolio of stocks and bonds. Effectively, they're getting orders from their financial portfolio, how much oil to buy and sell as an optimal hedge against inflation. They tend to be long-only funds, but their position became extremely dynamic, so they're no longer holding fixed position. So they constantly adjust the size of their position when something happens in the financial markets. For example, interest rate went up or volatility of interest rate increased, then they have to do something on oil because there is a big spillover effect on what they need to do on oil when something happens in financial markets. And finally, I think I should mention the option traders. I think there is a very, very large, as you know, over-the-counter market where all the end users hedge their corporate exposure, a lot of producers, some consumers. Everything is being hedged now via listed options on the exchange. And these options have to be managed by dealers. So when dealers manage their exposure, they have to transact in futures. And typically, they're short options. So they tend to sell in the falling market and buy in the rising market, effectively exacerbating the market move. I would say, again, we tend to bucket them all together. Oh, it's all funds, but not all funds are sort of a created equal. You can kind of see. And this is, I just mentioned like only three types of participants. Obviously, I can't recite the entire book. There is a lot of other folks trading for other reasons. Macro traders, quantamental traders, I'll just refer to the book for those. But those are kind of, I would say, three most important ones today.
Excellent. And we're going to use the SPR as a bit of a demonstration of how all these different forces interact and create sort of surprising outcomes. But broadly, the point being that all of these participants, you know, huge scale and all have not necessarily predictable, but they all have different incentives to the fundamental physical market. How does that physical market and the financial market now sort of come together, so to speak? I mean, at some point at the end of these contracts, they've got to reflect the physical, but can you give us some sense of how that all interacts?
Yeah, there is a big battle now going on between the largest player in the physical market, which is OPEC or OPEC Plus. And essentially, a lot of these financial market participants that OPEC refers to as speculators. I think the battle kind of escalated at the end of last year. If you remember, in the second part of last year, when OPEC was trying to cut the production, because back then, if you remember, basically the non-OPEC supplies were growing so fast that they were basically meeting the entire global demand growth. There was no really room for OPEC to grow. So OPEC had to cut the production to keep the market balance. So everybody was expecting it to be a bullish signal. Okay, OPEC cut the production a couple of million barrels per day. Very significant number. But guess what? The prices didn't go up. The prices actually went down in like October, November. So why did they go down? Well, back then, the algorithms, like in October last year alone, in just 1 month, the algorithm sold roughly about 200 million barrels per day of futures. So if you take this 200 million, kind of divided it by 30 days, that's roughly 7 million financial barrels per day. So here is your battle. So OPEC is reducing physical supplies by 1 or 2 million barrels per day, but CTAs or algo are essentially selling 7 million barrels per day, which is like four times larger. So not surprisingly, the prices went down. And now what's happening now, those CTAs are still short. So they are roughly shorter than their historical norms by the same 200 million barrels. And I think their behavior is going to determine where the price is going to go in the next couple of months. Their patterns are actually changing. And then with the just mere passage of time, their technical bearish signals are going to flip to bullish or become less bearish, which means that OPEC will ultimately probably win this battle because time is on their side. The simple passage of time is going to force algorithms to basically cover their short position, which probably is going to happen in the next couple of months. And now the physical market, in my opinion, is going to win this battle, and that could potentially lead to a substantially higher oil prices, because when algorithms sold in October and November, that cost oil probably $10 to $15 a barrel cheaper. It weakened prices. Now, if they're going to have to buy back all these financial shorts, which most likely they will, just again with the passage of time, then it can easily add $10 to $15 a barrel of price appreciation in the near future. So we're kind of talking about getting pretty close to $100 a barrel again. So in this case, again, the algorithms come and go, but OPEC is playing this game very smartly and patiently, and patience is on their side. And I think, in my opinion, they're going to force algorithms to cover the shorts.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because if I think back to this time last year, most of the commentary about oil prices was all driven by the fundamentals, right? The physical piece. And as you're highlighting, ultimately the physical, it all comes back to physical. But because you've got these different participants at scale, these algorithmic traders and so forth, there's obviously sort of this, there's a long-term lag to these switches now. And, you know, it's interesting about who was thinking about this piece. And, you know, there was very little in the market outside of, you know, we had Greg Newman on a couple of times and did a live podcast event there, which actually all the panels spoke about this impact, but it's not necessarily widely, you know, you don't see it in the Wall Street Journal necessarily. So you kind of had this long-term lag as this wave motion of algos swap between strategies. Is there also a short-term aspect to this as well, in that all of these participants, these virtual barrels, create a lot more potential for volatility when you get specific events happen and they all switch to a particular, you know, the strategy immediately changes. I mean, can you get some sense of that kind of dynamic between sort of the longer-term lag effect created by these organizations, but also the short-term volatility spikes you can see?
I mean, as you said, we historically the media has been focusing mostly on fundamentals, but I think things are changing because honestly, the fundamentals are kind of boring. And I've had a number of conversations with the sell side bank analysts. They basically have to produce a report every week for their customers, like their oil weeklies, whatever, and they were basically like crying, whining, is like, Ilya, we have nothing to talk, or nothing to write about it. We know that the markets are driven by these speculators, but the general audience doesn't understand them. So fortunately, things are beginning to change, and you see more and more stories are being published by Wall Street Journal now, by Bloomberg. Well, we can't make up fundamental stories anymore, right? Because they're not the ones driving the market. So in the past, it was difficult to explain to the audience, to the readers. And I'm glad that you are doing this podcast and asking these questions, because everybody on the trading side knows that this is what drives the market, but the general audience doesn't. And that's honestly, that was one of the main motivation for me to write this book. Well, somebody has to write about it. And I think you have to acknowledge the reality. Things are changing. They're not the same as they were 10 years ago. Even that number that I gave you, $5 billion of futures trading today versus $100 million of consumption, even like 5-10 years ago, the ratio was so much smaller. So you can see that growth continue every single month. And I've seen ICE set a new record volumes last month. So it's going to continue to grow, and I think it's going to change. And I hope, again, the more folks like you and myself and other traders, I think we can help educating the broader audience of what really drives the oil prices.
Yeah. Although I myself am clinging on by my fingertips in terms of understanding. But just can you address that short term? Was it sort of that hypothesis that not only do you get to get these long term lags now to the fundamentals, do we see these short term much higher volatility in the wake of events because the response of algorithms to a, whatever it might be, right? A ship goes down in the Gulf or whatever.
Yeah, the short term supply and demand in oil are inelastic, right? If supply exceeds demand today, it's more likely supply is going to exceed demand tomorrow. So that's like short term fundamentals. They're just inelastic. They're not changing every day by much. So if the markets were driven solely by fundamentals, the volatility would have been really close to zero, but it's not. In the long term, of course, fundamentals prevail, and the long term oil prices, I mean, give or take, should be driven by the marginal cost of production, plus probably some geopolitical or some other risk premium, of course, but the markets are there on a daily basis, and the algorithms are so much faster to react than fundamentals.
Yeah, I guess that's my question, though. You know, algorithms are driven by past performance and trends and whatever they're coded to do. But it's just if you get a shock or an event that the algorithms haven't anticipated. And my point is, are these things so quick to react that they become self-reinforcing that you can have these big price spikes either way that you wouldn't have had 10, 15 years ago when it would have been managed by physical traders, you know, figuring out between themselves how to overcome?
Absolutely. I would say now it's a great example, and it's kind of related to my view that I just mentioned a few minutes ago, that algorithms are very short and there is a big risk that they're going to cover their position. Algorithms are not very good in modeling geopolitical risks because it's very hard to model. It's very hard to backtest your strategies because there are just not enough episodes in the history that they can use for backtesting. So they don't understand it. So if you, knock on wood, get some kind of major event, their immediate reaction is going to be everything is off quickly. So they're going to react and close out their position in response to any sort of a minor catalyst in prices. And obviously, if you have to close, imagine you have to close 7 million barrels per day of futures in a month. I mean, that's what is going to escalate this short-term volatility. So absolutely. So it's going to cause more volatility short term comparing to the days when the markets were mostly controlled by large physical trade shops.
Yeah. It's fascinating. We've recently done an episode on forecasting and some of the challenges there that, you know, the complexity today, the decoupling geopolitically, you know, there's a lot more risks than sort of the quiet decades previously. Let's move to the SPR, which I know you've been up to the hill on as well and spent a lot of time thinking about. Can you just give us a quick primer on what the SPR is? And I guess weave all these factors we've been discussing into how that narrative has played out and indeed is playing out.
Yeah, SPR, maybe I'll start with a just super quick refresher what SPR really is. SPR, Strategic U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It's basically the world's largest storage facility. Oil is owned by a federal government. It's stored in massive salt caverns. There are about 60 of them spread out in four sites in Texas and Louisiana. Just to give people an idea, some of these caverns are so large that you can put the entire Empire State Building in a single cavern. So it was established in, I believe, 1975 in the aftermath of the oil embargo. Oh, we're going to be celebrating 50-year anniversary next year.
Yep.
So, it has a double mission, really. So one is to diminish the impact of petroleum supplies on the U.S. economy, and the other one to carry some of U.S. international obligations under international law. So So the magnitude of it, the total capacity is around 720 million barrels. So currently it's half full, or I should say half empty. So the releases of SPR that everybody has been talking about, the stocks can be released in two different ways. So one is via competitive sales, and the other one via basically exchanges. So exchanges are effectively loans, and this is my favorite tool, and I always have been a big proponent of the using of this tool. So the loans means this is how the physical storage manager is managing the storage in the commercial setting. So let's say if the market is backward and the oil is 20% cheaper forward than it is today, then I can give you, Paul, 100 barrels today, and if oil is cheaper forward, you're going to give me back 120 barrels. So I effectively generated 20% return by lending you barrels with no risk. So I basically call it a risk-free return. So the second method is a competitive sales, where you essentially sell oil out of SPR and then hope to buy it back at some point in the future. But this is obviously very risky because the price may not go down, or if the price go up, you end up buying it back at a much higher price. So as traders, we all know you're effectively lagging the spread, and lagging could be quite risky. But anyway, this is just a basic background of what SPR is and how do you draw stocks out of SPR.
The HC Insider podcast is brought to you by HC Group, a retained search, intelligence and advisory firm focused solely on the global energy and commodity sector. With 6 locations across Asia, Europe and the Americas, and over 50 consultants. To find out more, go to our website, hcgroup.global. There, you can also sign up for our HC Insider content for more interviews and white papers on relevant trends and talent impacts in the commodities world.
You know, obviously this is a political story as well, in the sense that, so a couple of years ago, in the wake of high inflation numbers, the Biden administration starts to sell oil from the SPR to try and keep fuel prices down. Can you sort of, is that correct? And kind of tell us the story from there.
Yeah. That's unfortunately, even though administration did some oil loans at the end of 2021, which I love, and I think I always thought it's a great idea. But the majority of SPR releases were done in the form of sales. Just to give you an idea about the magnitude, sales during 2022 were three times larger, about 180 million barrels. They were three times larger than all of the sales combined in the previous 47 years. So in 1 year, we sold three times more than in the previous 47 years combined. So that's a big volume for sure. So what has been happening since that time? So basically, give or take, those sales, 180 billion, generated around $18 billion. But then there was also some mandatory Congress-approved sales that were done separately under separate authorities. So as a way to buy back the sales, essentially the administration netted the buyback against the previously Congress-approved sales. So essentially that was a way to cancel or to net the two. That was for 140 million barrels. So this 140 are not going to be bought back because they already were netted against the previously Congress-approved sale. So to get to the bottom line is after this netting, so you got out of 18 billion, you have roughly about $6 billion left in the SPR account. So you can only buy realistically about one third of what you sold, so about 60 million barrels total that you can buy. And this is why our president said not long time ago that they are indeed targeting to buy about 60 million barrels. So what I was really advocating for a long time, why don't we buy it in the forward market? Because there's a lot of argument that the administration can only buy about 3 million barrels per day. But you can do a forward contract where you can buy 3 million barrels per day for the next year or two while the prices are still cheap. And besides, by buying forward, you're buying at a cheaper price. So you can lock in, well, not today, but like a month ago, you could have locked in $70 to $75 a barrel and just replenish your SPR via forward contract and have the dealers deliver oil to you ratably, 3 million barrels per month. So that was kind of what I was advocating when I called to testify. And then I'm super happy that more recently the Department of Energy actually started to buy forward. They're not doing it as a single deal, but over the last few months, they were issuing contracts for 3 million barrels per month to buy back. They're like one at a time, but every couple of weeks they were extending it for 1 month at a time. And I think the last one was issued for July. So it's already almost half a year forward. So that kind of made me happy. So that eventually I'd like to quote Winston Churchill on this, that eventually you can count on Americans to do the right thing, but after they have tried everything else. So I think things are going the right way now.
Yeah. Just to understand just a little bit sort of more the context of that, it obviously became a bit of a political football and a touchstone for, again, you know, the divisions that are going on in Congress. How, with the administration, with the people that oversee the SPR, how sophisticated is the understanding of all of those individuals with respect to the futures market and the impact of virtual barrels, as you've been saying?
I think I'm not privy to all the details, but I think it's improving significantly. A couple of like data points for you. When they first tried to buy back SPR, they failed because there was no really takers. And one of the reasons that in the very first attempts to buy, they were asking dealers to hold the price, fixed price of oil, I forgot, like for a week or 2 weeks or something like this. But as a dealer in the futures market, you cannot hold a fixed price offer for 2 weeks. The price can move against you. So you effectively short the option. If you're holding the price, you short the option for 2 weeks, and that option worth like $5 a barrel. So no wonder when the dealers responded, their price quotations were significantly higher than what SPR was hoping for. So it took them a few months to probably realize that this is not the right thing to do. So they learned that by asking the dealers to hold the fixed price firm, you're effectively competing with the derivatives market, and you're not going to be competitive in doing this. So they changed the way how they have written the contract. Again, I don't want to get into nuances on that, but they have significantly improved. In terms of like how much they understand it, I think they understand a lot more than what they kind of announced. But as you said, it's highly political. For example, when the administration claims that the release of SPR contributed to significant decrease in gasoline prices, this is wrong, because that argument was based on some academic papers with the data which are totally irrelevant to the current market conditions, based on the data going back to the dates when the futures market didn't even exist. So the reason it happened, it was fortunate that at the same time, again, the same CTAs were very concerned about the probability of recession and slowdown in the economy. So they were the ones who ultimately sold the market back then. And then, well, SPR might have contributed just a little bit, but by no means the release of SPR had a major effect on oil prices. And I guess to see another example, if I happen to be right, and if algorithms are going to cover their shorts today, so you're going to see the reverse effect of prices rallying, and again, it has nothing to do with SPR. So I think they understand more, but they are not going to be open about it, saying that the market is no longer driven by the forces of supply and demand.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, we'll have to get this episode out pretty quick so that your people can benefit from your predictions. But that is a fascinating statement that actually the SPR narrative didn't have an impact. Just one more question on the SPR before we just go quickly to look at sort of the where you think the future is headed. You know, in the wake of the US being absolutely dominant in global oil production at the moment, is there even a reason to have the SPR at the moment?
I think so. I'm a big supporter of having SPR. I mean, things are going to become more volatile, especially with the energy transition. With the energy transition, the physical usage can actually diminish, but the financial markets are not going to decrease. If anything, they're going to get larger and larger. So things are going to become probably more volatile. So how do you manage this volatility? Okay, well, SPR is one of the tools because ultimately storage is a buffer. The whole concept of storage, the purpose of storage is to kind of shift supplies from the times when they're plentiful to the times when they're scarce. So that's ultimately what you're doing. You're basically creating a buffer against the volatility. So you need more of these real options to basically help in managing this volatility. Yeah, that's one point. And then the other point is, remember I mentioned that the SPR has two missions. So one is really to diminish against the impact of supply disruptions on the US economy. The other one is to fulfill international obligations. Well, technically the international obligation in the event of a major geopolitical crisis is to release the strategic reserves, stocks. Technically, the way how it's calculated, it's based on the net imports of the country. We are not importing anything. If anything, U.S. is technically an exporter now. So legally, the U.S. doesn't really have any international obligation. However, practically and ethically, if you look at all the past coordinated releases across countries, U.S. has always contributed roughly 50% of that. So it has almost like nothing to do with the U.S. imports. If anything, U.S. is still the biggest consumer. So sometimes the allocation of this release is still driven by the consumption rather than imports, even though legally it's via imports. So you need to have SPR still to meet some of those obligations, even though they're no longer legal, they're much more of an ethical. So again, there are two reasons at least to have an SPR. One is a volatility buffer. Well, the second one is also about a volatility buffer, but more like on an international scale.
Yeah. And if I'm still clinging on, the point being that eventually the financial markets come back to the physical. Right. So whilst the SPR releases might not have been had much of an effect in those price drops, you know, eventually at that sort of scale, it will have an impact. And, you know, of course, it matters in the physical space.
It's going to contribute to the physical space for sure. But let's not always be like fooled that eventually the futures price converge with spot price, because in the oil market, the entire concept of physical spot price doesn't really exist. The price for the physical oil, as you know, in the oil market is always determined by futures plus or minus a differential. So the primary price formation will always be in the futures market. The physical barrel price, the price for physical barrels, is always going to be some kind of minor differential to the futures price. So from that perspective, the supply and demand for financial barrels is going to be the primary determinant of the futures price. And that the physical price is going to be tied to that.
Perfect. Okay. And then looking toward, I guess, you know, just the last 5 minutes, putting this all together, and you've already mentioned that the expectation is that the virtual barrels are going to increase and multiply versus the physical. What does that mean when you look for the next decade for, I guess, the markets themselves, but also crucially, you know, given your lecturing at NYU, the talent piece?
Yeah, I think the commodities market just basically following the same path as the equity market went. I think we're just probably like 10 years behind. So if you know, like 20 years ago, equities were trading mostly by fundamental stock pickers. Now the entire equities markets are driven by algorithms. That's where the commodities markets are going. and oil being the most liquid commodity benchmark is definitely in the front of that transition. So, but keep in mind that even though the oil futures are larger than physical consumption, the financial oil market is much, much tiny comparing to financial equities and bond markets. So just to give you an idea, I think the oil futures market are less than 0.5% of the equity market. So there is a massive potential for oil futures market to grow. So let's say hypothetically, if every investor decides to allocate 5% of capital to various oil-related strategies, that means the oil market can go from 0.5% to 5%, another factor of 10. I know I'm like throwing very large numbers. It's not going to happen in reality. But to give you an idea how much more potential for this non-fundamental money to come to the oil market, that's very, very significant. So, and I think, and it's also the natural evolution in trading. So everything is driven by technology. So we all now like communicate in a different way, and technology is coming everywhere. You cannot ignore this change. And I can see it in my class and my students. And my students actually know when they come to class, they know very little about commodity markets, but they are well equipped with various machine learning techniques, sophisticated statistical tools, and they know there is a lot of data in commodities where these tools can be applied. Just, and I think one of the things that motivates, and maybe somebody from my class is going to be the one who is going to bring AI into oil trading. I think it's coming. It's not quite there yet, but I think it might come at some point in the future.
Yeah, lots of people brand their stuff AI, but you're suggesting that true AI isn't there.
Not yet. I mean, again, I'm trying myself and I'm working on a bunch of projects. And AI is a bit generic term, so we are trying different machine learning strategies. I mean, there's a lot of other academic research, a lot of work being done on that. Frankly, there is nothing yet to brag about, and I carefully study and replicate everything that's being published there. But maybe in a few years, you'll invite me for another podcast if we decide to, if we actually come up with something that's worth advertising. But yeah, not at the moment yet.
Just, you know, what would the impact be if someone truly gets AI, generative AI, you know, to I mean, what is that? Is that just more of the same? It's just you've got slightly, you know, you're paying fewer people. You know, what would that actually mean, particularly in terms of talent?
I think there is still more talent to come to this industry. And one of the calculations, I kind of did it on a piece of paper. I didn't really write about it in the book or anywhere else. So if I take the amount of risk capital being transferred on a daily basis in the oil market, and you can sort of estimate it by looking at futures volumes, again, multiplying by volatility. I'm talking about the amount of risk capital, how much dollars are being transferred between participants in the oil market, and compare it to a bunch of other asset classes, FX, rates, equities. And then I'm going to divide it by the number of traders involved. So the amount of risk capital per trader involved in the energy space is probably larger than everywhere else. To kind of put it in a different perspective, there is still more money to be made or lost per trader in this space, which is going to continue to attract talent into that space, especially quantitative talent, because they think that their skill of machine learning and AI could actually materially contribute to that path.
Fascinating. Well, Ilya, it's always a pleasure to have you on. I do look forward to having you back on in the future, talking about exactly how the markets have continued to evolve and this subject in particular. We'll put some links to some of the relevant papers that have come up in this discussion, particularly at Oxford Energy. And thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to support the show, please give us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
To find out more about HC Insider and HC Group, a search and advisory firm dedicated to the commodity markets, visit our website at www.hcgroup.global. There you can find out more about our services and our offices around the world. There you can also find more content, from interviews to insight pieces to more podcasts focused on the commodity value chains. Thanks again for listening.